Biden hits the ground running, Morrison fires up the culture wars, and the good news is about rhinos. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the puppy-cuddling Van Badham, holding Germanicus on her lap. It's been a bit cold and windy where we live.
Oh, he's so sooky in the wind.
He doesn't like the wind.
Does not like it.
It's not his favourite thing at all.
So if I'm a bit squirmy, it's because I have squirmy puppy in my arms.
Now, we're back after the long weekend. And Van, tell me, it's been interesting. Biden has been in power now for 7 days.
Yes, it's hard to believe he's only been in power for 7 days. It's all happening very quickly in the United States of America.
He's really hit the ground running, hasn't he?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It is just crazy. And it is so funny because he is passing executive orders. So in the United States, they have obviously a different system to what we have in Australia, where they have their executive, which is their the office of the president, the cabinet, is not drawn from the Congress like the way ours is here. So the president has the capacity to enact executive orders that don't need to go before Congress. They don't need to be voted up as legislation, and he can pass them through. And his word goes. But there's also capacity within their system for initiatives to be passed that affect federal employees and allocations of federal resources that are based on a provision for budgetary decisions. So it's so interesting for me because the criticism that the Republicans were levelling at Biden in the lead up to the election, and everybody heard it because those guys really know how to message box. Oh, he's sleepy Joe Biden. He's sleepy Joe. And, you know, this guy's been around for 47 years. He's been in the Senate for 47 years and he's done nothing. Like, he's done nothing. What's this guy ever done? Well, actually, Joe Biden is one of the most successful sort of cross policy legislators in American history, who's always had a particular talent for bipartisan alliances and allegiances, and who's been very, very good at getting things passed and done. And this is when he was just a senator, long before he was president. And, you know, he was one of the sponsors of the Prevention of Violence Against Women Act. He was responsible for judicial appointments. He had very strong role in foreign policy, and his knowledge and understanding of how Washington and the system of government works in America is absolutely vast. And so you can understand why it's just going absolutely bananas. I'm going to read a list of just what he passed on the first day.
Sure.
The first day he was in office.
These are executive orders that he can basically decree.
He can decree these. All right, are you ready?
Yep. Day one.
Memorandum freezing approval of rules passed in the final days of the Trump presidency. Executive order rejoining the Paris Agreement on climate change. Executive order to promote racial equity. Proclamation ending ban on U.S. entry from majority Muslim countries. Executive order requiring mask wearing on federal property. Executive order coordinating a government-wide COVID-19 response. Executive order revising immigration enforcement policies. Executive order undoing regulatory restrictions on federal agencies. Executive order incorporating undocumented immigrants into census. Executive order refocusing on the climate crisis and cancelling the Keystone XL permit. Executive order banning discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. Memorandum revamping regulatory review. Executive order mandating ethics pledge for government appointees. Proclamation pulling funds from border wall. Executive order pausing federal student loan repayments. Memorandum reinstating deferred enforced departure for Liberians. Memorandum strengthening the deferred action for childhood arrivals.
That's day one.
So America's back, baby. And certainly the promises that he made in the lead up to the election, which were he was going to take a leadership position on climate action, that America would join the Paris Agreement, that a whole bunch of crazy stuff that Trump did, and the environmental vandalism of the Trump era may actually turn out to be Trump's most enduring legacy. I mean, they opened the Arctic wilderness area for oil and gas leases. You know, they proceeded with the stripping of regulation. One of those things that I just read out was a regulation that Trump brought in that for any government department to introduce a regulation, they had to remove two other regulations. So it's just been a free-for-all in the United States, and you can imagine what that's meant in terms of environmental protection and conservation and any kind of restriction around the kind of business practices that cause like climate damage and environmental damage. And he's just ripping through them. That was day one. By day three, he had reinstated the right of transgender Americans to serve in the military. They're doing heaps of stuff about restoring humanitarianism to American immigration and refugee policy and dealing with that stuff at the border. That was another point I wanted to make. Trump's border wall, build the wall. The border wall has been an environmental disaster. He's ceased the funds for it. The wall is over. And all of these things are happening with executive authority that he's just, he's in it for a good time, not a long time. The man is 78 years old. And it's like 47 years of insight and experience and understanding and a genuinely progressive heart has just enabled him to launch into space. It's amazing.
Well, it's been really interesting, hasn't it? Because the other things that he's done have been really around labour rights as well. So you've seen him fire the General Counsel for the National Labour Rights Board, which is supposed to be a board that promotes collective bargaining and promotes all the sort of good things about labour rights, and has been doing the reverse.
Yeah, well, because it was a Trump appointment, and Trump was no friend of the union movement. Trump is no friend of minimum wage. I wrote about this for The Guardian. Obviously, I recommend everybody read my Guardian piece this week, which is about the minimum wage situation in America, because one of the biggest things that Biden has done is already, in the past 10 minutes, basically, he has doubled minimum wage for federal government employees in the United States. So the minimum wage in America is an extraordinary thing to study in terms of looking at the divergence between an American conception of industrial fairness and Australian one. Mm. Obviously, Australia had the Harvester Judgment in 1907.
Something like that, yeah.
1907, which was a case about Harvester, the manufacturer of tractors and farm equipment and the treatment of their employees, where a judge ruled that there had to be minimum standards in place for workers to be paid properly, and that a single worker, and obviously this is based in a very patriarchal time, this notion of men as the heads of households, and you know we can critique that particular structure, but let's look at the good principle here, that the Harvester Judgment in Australia said that you should be able to feed a family of four and have a frugal but equitable, you know, income and lifestyle.
Yeah, you should be able to participate in the society in which you live.
Yeah, on the basis of one full-time salary. And that our industrial framework from that decision onwards has been based in respect and dignity towards people who are at the lowest end of the pay scale in Australia and unskilled labour and different kind of labour categories, that you should be able to live off what you were paid. Now, they didn't have that in America. They didn't introduce minimum wage until 1938, 31 years after we did. Mm. And of course, I think I've said it on this program before, people who oppose minimum wage are the people who would pay you nothing if they thought they could get away with it.
Oh, absolutely.
And minimum wage has been a really contentious issue in the United States. So there has not been a minimum wage increase in that country since 2009, that's 11 years ago, not like in Australia where we have a minimum wage case every year. It goes before the Fair Work Commission and everybody sort of dukes it out for an increase. And their minimum wage is $7.25 an hour federally. Now, of course, some people in some places get paid more because they have a system where their states can pass laws and even counties and cities can pass laws. But that's the federal guaranteed minimum, unless you work in hospitality. If you work in a diner, you hold the kind of jobs that I held for the majority of my adult life, and you work in a job that they consider to have a tipping component, where customers tip you for service, your minimum wage is $2.17 American an hour, because you're supposed to make up the rest in tips. It's absolutely it's crazy. Crazy system. And of course, Biden has said his commitment is to doubling the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And he's just done that for federal employees. And of course, this is transformative, because what this means, and this is what I wrote about in my piece this week, is that if that passes across the board, like if he can get a $15 American minimum wage mandated, American workers, for the first time in a very, very, very long time, and I'm talking more than half a century, will be better paid than our minimum wage workers in Australia. And it's a really sad indictment of how we've let our own system decay and our fights around, you know, maintaining really good wages and conditions. Successive Liberal governments have edged away and edged away and edged away and fought and fought and fought to really strip back our capacity. And obviously all of the suppression of union organising that goes on in this country, meaning unions can't just walk into workplaces and organise people. If you just walk into a workplace and organise people in this country, your union gets a fine.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the minimum wage and the kind of market rate wages, you know, these things do interact. So while the Liberal government has essentially overseen a freeze in wages across the board, even though the union movement has successfully had some increase in minimum wages, there hasn't been that big lift in minimum wages that places like America are considering now. UK has gone through a big minimum wage increase, South Korea, a whole range of these other countries where you're seeing pressure for the minimum wage to actually lift quite substantially.
Yeah.
Whereas in Australia, because there's been this kind of freeze on wages at the market rate, if you like, the median wage, the average wage hasn't really increased during the 7 years of Liberal Party rule in this country, it's much harder for a Fair Work Commission to make a decision to increase minimum wage.
And not to mention that we've also seen Liberal governments in this country strip away the concept of social wages.
Absolutely.
So social wages are things like Medicare and free education and you know, a welfare state that supports people and government investments in communities. You know, that there's a trade-off that goes on, that if you pay higher taxes, you know, that sometimes your wages are reduced, but you're not being bankrupted by medical bills, which we all know is what happens in the United States of America. One of the really interesting things that Biden is doing is he's reshaping that notion of social wages and government protection, because obviously Trump didn't deal with the coronavirus crisis at all. Like, we know he didn't. Yeah. You know, he was completely missing in action, talking like insane conspiracy theories. Is there a vaccine? Was there going to be a vaccine? Is the vaccine being rolled out? Who's rolling it out? I mean, it's a logistical disaster. They have the vaccine in America, and it's a logistical disaster. Today, Biden announced that they've bought enough vaccine now, and they've ordered enough doses that whole country of more than 300 million people will be vaccinated by the end of the summer. That's the commitment they're on. And he set up COVID task forces and all these things.
He's got half a dozen executive orders about COVID, putting in place the infrastructure.
One of them that's really important is that he's re-established a right for workers to not go to work if they're realistically threatened with infection from coronavirus.
Yeah.
So one of the big problems they've had with transmission in America, especially around communities of colour, and communities of colour are the working class in America now, like the people who work in service professions, people who work in, you know, insecure, low-wage industries. Those people have been rife with coronavirus because they couldn't afford to take time off to avoid it. And Biden is saying, no, none of that.
That's interesting too, isn't it? Because he's again reinstituted those kind of occupational health and safety regulations. He's instituted the ability to say, no, I'm not going to go to work if it's not safe. These are all things that we saw here in Australia, the arguments that were put up here around casualisation and insecure work.
But they were arguments put up by the union movement
Absolutely.
In this country and not by Scott Morrison. And you had the likes of the AFR and the Australian Financial Review, you know, the Tory newspaper of choice. I mean, the Australian is the one you read for fun, is that the AFR was saying, oh, well, you know, if some people die, that's the cost of running the economy. And of course, every economist on earth has gone, you can't run an economy when people are dropping dead of a virus.
That's
like, you can't actually economically function that way.
And COVID's really shown that actually the economy is reliant on people. You know, without people interacting, without people being safe to do so, without people being able to move around and buy things and transact with each other, there is no economic activity. And in fact, economic activity falls off a cliff. The more people feel unsafe, the more people feel insecure, the more people are unwell, the less economic activity there'll be. So it's really great to see Biden out there pushing hard early. And I saw the Congress, there's been a bill introduced as well to raise the minimum wage between now and essentially the end of his term in 2025.
Well, I sort of want to talk about this politically because this relates to what you're going to discuss today as well. And I should let everybody know the dog is clawing my leg to pieces. So I'm just going to put him on
He's having a cry, isn't he?
Oh, my God, what a sook you are. Okay, Mummy wants to talk about ideology, Joe. So in the lead up to the election, and as we know in this household, I never publicly express who I back in the Democratic nomination process.
Yep.
Like, obviously, I'm a person of very serious left-wing ideological commitments, as are you. And I just, I hate the whole nomination process because I hate the idea of the people on the same side, like, knocking chunks off one another. I can't bear it. But, you know, look, I do have my favourite candidates, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
And people could probably guess who the sentimental favourite was for me. But certainly you can recognise the enormous power and logic of nominating someone like Biden to be president and the enormous support that he did carry and the kind of communities he carried within that process as well. But in Australia, where people aren't necessarily down with the nuance of American politics and the way that ideology works in practice there, I think there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of insistence that Biden wasn't a particularly left-wing candidate, that he wasn't particularly progressive, and the word moderate was thrown around as if it was some kind of insult. Mm. And, you know, there was this belief that it'd be, oh, you know, more of the same. Where it's very clear within a week that Biden is certainly to the left of Obama.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he's...
Well, those sackings at the National Labor Relations Board were unprecedented. And the Republicans have made a big song and dance about that, saying, oh, Obama didn't do this. These people are normally allowed to see out their term. And Biden's saying, no, no, these people are not doing what they should be doing. And if they don't resign, they're fired. You know, like, straight out of the blocks. So,
but it's also interesting because for you and me, and coming from the sort of left-wing context that we come from, well, we are Laborist socialists. Like, we come from a tradition of communities being empowered through an organised working class, that is, through membership of trade unions, and trade unions equalising the balance of political forces. So ordinary people, ordinary working men and women and the communities around them that they support can have purchase and participation in the decisions that affect them and achieve equity, equality and fairness within the economy and by extension through their social and personal lives. And it's interesting sort of watching the way that discourses get manipulated, particularly on the internet, that there's this idea that being left-wing is just about being sort of socially progressive and holding various public moral positions on things like inclusion and representation and, you know, and freedom of expression and also on and also on a social conversation around respect and dignity, when what kind of speech is appropriate, where is it appropriate. And these can form the basis of really quite contentious political discussions around, you know, what are called identity politics and, of course, about like a social negotiation of who we are and that old chestnut, to quote Bertolt Brecht, how to be good in a bad society. And it means that, you know, it's interesting that that sort of focus is there in this sort of, you know, very shallow understanding of what it actually means to be left-wing and what Biden is doing, which is, yeah, actually, we're going to double the minimum wage and we are going to sack people at the Labor Board and we are going to use climate change as an opportunity to industrially reinvest in America and American jobs and industrial opportunities for working class people and people who want to be working class. And he's appointed Janet Yellen as the Treasury Secretary. And this is an extraordinary appointment. Like, Janet Yellen's been around for a while. She's an older person. She's amazingly qualified. She was the chair of the Economic Advisory Council. She was, chair of the Federal Reserve. Like, she's a hugely powerful, qualified economic actor. But she's a Keynesian. Like, she's not a neoliberal. And Janet Yellen, in the 80s and 90s, when everybody was drinking the neoliberal Kool-Aid, even people theoretically on the left, and let's privatise everything and, you know, everything will trickle down, whatever. She held the line and she was like, this is not going to work. These are the politics of and economics of unfairness. You know, this is going to result in massive wealth transfer to the already rich, deprive the poor, will eviscerate the middle class. Like, this is what's going to happen. And the idea that she would be his pick for the most powerful economic position in America is transformative. And the kind of team that he's building around these key material transformations of the American economy and society it's really exciting. It's a really exciting time. And I'm all in. We all know I've always had a bit of a thing for the union boys and 100% Joe Biden in your corner.
Well, you know, again, it is the material changes, isn't it? There's sure, there are some things that you'd say some of the executive orders have an element of symbolism to them and are about indicating the direction rather than delivering something. But so many of them, you'd have to say 90% of them are about material change. And he's only been in the job a week. You know, like I've always been one of those people that goes, this whole transition process that America goes through and takes months and handover shouldn't take that long, all the rest of it. Well, I've got to say, he's used that time really, really wisely because, as you say, Yellen has already been confirmed by the Senate. I think that happened yesterday.
Yeah.
Most of his cabinet is now confirmed. All these executive orders, things are rolling and they're rolling fast. I saw today that Michelle O'Neill, the president of the ACTU, had a piece in the SMH and the Age talking about the opportunities of climate change. Now that America is absolutely going to lead the way, Australia and Scott Morrison can no longer afford to bury their heads in the sand. Of course, this has happened.
Why would we? I mean, this is what does my head in. Why would we miss those opportunities? On the show last week, we talked about my good news section was about ply scrapers and the fact that timber technology is now building buildings that are up to 28 stories high. And the Japanese are building wooden satellites to put into space. Yep. Wooden satellites. It's amazing. And why wouldn't we be investing now? I mean, trees take a while to grow. Now is the time to look at how about we restore forestry communities? How about we look at manage forestry? How about we look at investment in those kind of jobs and those kind of industries of the future? We are a prosperous first world country. We can do that now. But no, Scott
Morrison. Well, at the same time, you've got Scott Morrison's government, the Nationals, calling for more coal-fired power stations. Like their pathway is apparently to have more coal. There's division within the coalition government about this, and you've seen Barnaby Joyce, I think, just today come out and attack the marriage, in inverted commas, with the Liberal Party. You've seen Liberal MPs, particularly those in city electorates, say that this plan of the Nationals is out there and not going to work. And, of course, all of this is happening in this global context that we're talking about, where you've got Biden, you've got Europe, you've got the UK under Boris Johnson, all moving to net zero emissions. Michelle O'Neill's article today I thought was really good to say we can't afford to be an outlier anymore. And the reason why, Van, I think that we've been an outlier fundamentally is about politics. You know, the kind of culture wars that Morrison is encouraging, he's using the template that Tony Abbott really perfected so well and doing it with a bit more of the Howard nuance, right? So absolutely having the Nationals fire up about coal and climate change in a negative way and without him stepping on it, right? He hasn't stepped on that, just like he didn't step on Craig Kelly's conspiracy theories about vaccines, just like he, some would say, deliberately kicked off a firestorm before Australia Day, talking about it wasn't a real flash day for the convicts either.
Well, this is what you were going to talk about today, and you were going to talk about how Scott Morrison is really perfecting the culture war.
Absolutely.
Political engagement model. So, I mean, do you want to explain what a culture war is? Because we use that term all the time, but on this show we do love explaining things.
Well, effectively, culture war is where you set up to divide people within the community or within the nation around what the perception of the culture of that nation or that community is about, fundamentally. And you've seen this with Liberal governments over time, really since Howard, back when he was opposition leader. Instead of trying to work towards national unity with Keating around reconciliation, Howard really pushed the Mabo means you're going to lose your backyard, black people are getting things they're not entitled to, Aboriginal people will build walls around parts of Western Australia and stop the export of iron ore and coal. They literally ran TV ads around this kind of stuff, right?
Oh, I remember very painfully, you're perhaps a little young, when in the 80s Howard was really campaigning against Asian immigration, saying that it was too divisive for Australia.
You know, so this kind of culture, as in who we are, what is our culture, how do we identify ourselves, and how do we, and really othering parts of our culture. Now, this is done usually to distract people from the material realities that government is supposed to focus on.
Oh, yeah, there's scare campaigns around perception. Because
absolutely.
If you're terrified about, you know, ships full of invading hordes, whether they're refugees or economic migrants or anybody else, or if you think that there's going to be, you know, fences in your backyard from land rights decisions, legislation or these, I mean, things that are not happening.
That's right.
That nobody is actually arguing or trying to make happen, and yet to engender this fear in the community that something they are in possession of will be lost. And that's basically, and you see this stuff with the relentless harassment of transgender people, particularly transgender youth. The idea that, oh, well, you know, boys and girls won't be boys and girls anymore, and yeah, you know, it's just the nature of the family will collapse. And
what Morrison is really starting to do is to set these little fires, these little culture war fires. So really, even in the last couple of weeks, right, because you can't just explode a culture war. You know, you've got to build up to it. You've got to create the perception of fear. You've got to create the perception that there are in-groups and out-groups. And it's actually quite subtle in a way. You need people to make the connection to why the out-group is a threat to your material reality without specifically going and saying, these people are a threat to your material reality. Because people are a bit more nuanced than that. That's why they call things like dog whistle is a term, right? Because
And stalking horses.
All these sorts of terms that are used. You know, just the last sort of 10 days, you've seen the stuff around not flash for the convicts, you know, that's really about setting up, was about setting up Australia Day to continue to be a period of division rather than a period of unity. And to say anyone who thinks it's about division is on the outside, yet his actions are setting up the division. Right.
Yeah, and this idea that if we change the date of Australia Day, which
Keating created,
of course we should.
We should remember here, Keating created Australia Day as a national holiday in 1994, right? So at the same time as Morrison and his acolytes are trying to unpick a whole bunch of Keating stuff around super, they're absolutely using Keating's national holiday to create these culture wars, right? It's not just Australia Day. I mean, the fact that Margaret Court was given the highest honour...
Outrageous.
It wasn't even just that was outrageous. These things normally don't leak, right? And it was leaked. It was leaked. It was leaked days ahead. So the whole build-up was around this big fight. And you saw people like Kerry O'Brien give up their award because they didn't want to be associated with Margaret Court. Now, I can understand why Kerry O'Brien
Margaret
did
Court,
that.
You know, formerly great tennis player.
Yeah, who
now,
was recognised for that
everywhere.
Some 10, 15 years ago.
Richard Dennis did a tweet that listed all of the awards and honours that she has received beyond just winning tennis trophies, all the recognition that she's been given in her lifetime. The idea that you would reward her now is, I mean, it's a bit deliberate,
really. Morrison...
And she's a religious bigot. Like, she's a hateful, homophobic religious bigot.
Yes,
and that's true.
And Morrison, you know, voted against marriage equality, right? Like, let's be clear. He has been really clear about that. He was not in favour of marriage equality, and he left the chamber when the legislation was being put up to be voted on and to be enacted. So there is a connection there ideologically with those two people. And her being honoured created this firestorm, this cultural firestorm.
Oh, it's more than that, because it's their particular kind of religious sectarianism as well, which is predicated not on anything I recognise in the Bible, but this sort of, you know, pseudo-religious justification to hate on minorities.
Oh, it's outrageous. You know, there's also the things around the ABC, right? So creating the ABC as a point of cultural tension. It's their ABC, right? This is the kind of language they use. Cutting the funding for it, even though it's recognised as being really important to regional communities in particular.
Oh, yeah, maybe with a bit of, you know, fire warnings and, you know, any kind of emergency management. The ABC literally keeps communities alive.
Right. So
what kind of infrastructure do people think we have out in the country? Like, do they think that we just have, like, jets in the backyard or something, that if a fire hits, we'll just, you know, we're wearing telepathic helmets and we just know what to do and can just run out to the jet and, like, chuff off to evade the fire? Like, do people just not get what it's like out here?
I'm not sure having a Prime Minister from the North Shore is any better than having a Prime Minister.
Darling, he's from the eastern suburbs. It's a lot more expensive than the North Shore.
Oh, there you go. So, you know, but at the same time, what I want to say about the ABC is you look at what happened with Fletcher, right? The communications minister came out when the ABC said Australia Day, sometimes referred to as Invasion Day. Fletcher put out a media release saying this was unacceptable. The ABC cannot refer to it as Invasion Day. Now, culturally, Australia is getting more engaged with what actually happened, you know, back then when the convicts arrived, and what happened as a result of the arrival of the convicts, and the failed British military careerists who were overseeing them, was dispossession, mass murder, dehumanisation.
Biological warfare.
This all happened to the Indigenous population of Australia. So to refer to it as Invasion Day is not totally beyond the realms of understanding. And we're seeing a cultural change in Australia. Now, creating a culture war around that is useful for a government that wants people to react negatively to change. You know, if you're a sitting government, things haven't been necessarily going your way in terms of unemployment is up and it remains high and will continue to remain high. Wages growth will continue to be low, record low levels of wages growth. You want to make some changes around...
being outstripped by the United States and their new minimum wage.
That's right. You want to make some changes around retirement that will leave people worse off. You want to make some changes around healthcare that might mean people are more out of pocket. You want to do some of these things that are going to leave people worse off overall. You want to make it easier to fire people. You want to make it legal for businesses to cut wages.
More expensive to get trained so you can, you know...
all these sorts of things.
Proceed in your career and get promoted in your job. Yeah.
So to do all of that stuff, you need to create an environment where the overwhelming fear is not about an immediate economic
material change,
but a cultural change about something that feels wrong, something that feels like it's been shifting, that you don't feel like you've had control over, so that you don't go and endorse another party that maybe is prepared to address some of those things more openly and more actively. And this is what we're seeing with Scott Morrison. You know, it's ongoing, right? Like trying to ban the Eureka flag on construction sites. That's a brilliant little cultural war set up between unions, because construction sites are heavily unionised, versus people who go, oh, but hang on a minute, unions, they're not good. Unions drive industry out of business, and unions are, you know, mean people are overpaid in some of these places, and the construction unions, they're all too militant, right? And maybe we should ban the Eureka flag. But let's look at the reality of that. The reality of that is the federal government is saying to businesses they will be banned from doing government projects if they allow workers to fly a flag that workers have flown for over 150 years.
And let's remember, like, the strategies around culture wars is that it's about finding what will stick.
Yeah.
So in different generations, the Conservatives target different groups of people to be the other. And obviously in Australia, the arts community cops it every so often.
Oh, all
like,
the time.
You know, we're all terrible lovies and indulgent, don't have real jobs, and we don't know what it's like to work. And, you know, this illusion that, you know, we're all this sort of spoiled middle class people, despite the fact rather a lot of people in the arts barely make minimum wage given the way that their work is structured. And, you know, or it could be communities of Indigenous and First Nations people wanting land rights, or it could be refugees, or it could be the LGBTQIA community. Like, they find whatever is the group that they can other and out and position to be the threat to what we understand to be Australia. Because I look at the Australia Day debate and it's like this, and sort of what's being dog whistled, what's being intimated is that changing the date will mean losing a holiday, banning barbecues, setting the flag on fire, that suddenly all of these things that we associate with this, you know, one day of the year will disappear and could be gone from our culture, where literally the discussion is, can we maybe have a collective decision as a nation for all of the barbecues and flags and, you know, eskies, thongs, whatever you want to describe, you smear Vegemite, you know, like on the walls, if you want, do it. If that's what being Australian means to you, go crazy, just on another day. Like literally, you could put it a week back.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it, right? Like, it's always about the fear. It's about the fear of losing something that you don't feel you have control over, that someone takes it from you. And that's what culture wars are about. Culture wars are about somebody else taking something from you that you have no control over because they're different, and creating a space where you can say, do, be really awful to your fellow Australians.
Because you feel emotionally justified in doing so.
And they've been identified as different and therefore lesser.
And I want to talk about the media strategy with this stuff as well, because the Conservatives really understand how media works because, you know, this week they gave a medal to Rupert Murdoch. And the model of the culture war is really, it's a propaganda model as well. You pick something that is really just, that often just comes down to a matter of taste or society or social behaviour or social activity. Yeah. A really good example is the Bill Henson paintings, right? So Bill Henson, contemporary Australian artist, does these artworks that are about puberty and about the sort of twilight between childhood and adulthood and depicting. And of course, this became this massive scandal. This is, I think, back during Rudd, you know, the Conservatives were like, oh, this is outrageous. And, you know, this is exploitation of children and blah, 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 and became this kind of thing. The way that it works in the media is you take that issue that has, by the way, no victims. There are no victims to the way that Bill Henson creates art. And even depicting young people, it's all negotiated with the parents. It's all in a safe environment. Anyway. But the issue is that because it fires people up emotionally, it preys on sometimes some really suppressed subconscious stuff. I mean, you can see this with the crazy Q thing in America where a lot of people who are survivors of legitimate childhood sexual abuse are attracted to this idea that we can fight the pedophiles and we can take down this cabal and the rest of it. You know, they deliberately play on these kind of emotional issues to do with home and sanctity and identity and feeling safe and these kind of things. And because it affects people emotionally, people start talking about it. The way a modern media model works is that you write it, and I can say this as a columnist, I'm asked to write about the things people are talking about and to provide, you know, clarity around an issue from the perspective of my publication as an individual. Like, obviously, I don't represent I don't represent The Guardian, but The Guardian have me on staff because they're interested in my opinion, believe in audiences too. So what happens is the phone calls come, can you write about this? This is what people are talking about. And I could see it with the Australia Day thing. And I try very hard not to talk about Australia Day. I make a solidarity statement to First Nations Australia, and that's it. That's as far as I'll go. When they change the date, I promise to God I will wear an Australian flag hat, probably not with a Union Jack on it, maybe probably more of a Eureka theme, but I will, you know, barbecue in my thongs. And but it's not appropriate. And I don't want to get drawn into being in that discussion. Like, I don't want to be part of the distraction mechanism that goes around people like Scott Morrison and his white friends deliberately blowing that one up.
Yeah.
Like, I will back in Indigenous voices, absolutely, but I don't, I can, you can see it every time. And the Margaret Court thing, and they knew when they picked her that obviously everybody would arc up and then all the columns come out and then there's like days and days and days of reporting about it. The IR Omnibus bill is being planned at the moment.
Unemployment figures last week. You know, there's going to be inflation figures this week. These are the things that will impact people's material life. And I'm not saying that the other things, that the cultural things aren't important. Of course they're important. If they weren't important, they wouldn't be setting all these fires, trying to create a real bonfire, right? Of course they're important. But they're doing it to try and remove people from their material reality, which is high levels of unemployment, record low wage growth, making it easier to fire you, messing with your retirement. These are all...
Sorry, I couldn't hear what you said.
That's from my phone joining the discussion. Don't worry, darling, I'm sure he'll repeat it. But, I mean, this is what gets said about Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, senators from Kentucky, right? Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul have been senators for decades, and what have they actually delivered for the people of Kentucky? Well, they've kicked off about a number of culture war issues, and they've talked about how abortion is bad. Oh, abortion's bad, says Mitch McConnell. Oh, it's really bad. And you know, one of my favourite commentators, Tom Nichols, was saying this week that at some point you have to look at how Kentucky is performing economically. It's got some of the highest unemployment, the most, you know, some of the poorest counties in America, low health outcomes, low education outcomes. With those two guys who've been representing it all that time. And he said at some point, you've just got to ask yourselves, do people vote for them because they hate themselves, or they hate the people who Mitch and Rand hate?
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to. And the American situation, like Kentucky, is sort of the end game of these kind of culture war politics, where you can convince people to behave politically against their own material interests and their own opportunities based on these like sort of boogie monsters that you pull out of the dark. And it's terrifying. But, you know, to relate this back to Biden and why I think Biden's was so effective and is going to be effective, is that material change actually affects social momentum.
Absolutely.
Because when you start building the infrastructure of jobs and economic security, and we see this whenever we get a Labor government in this country, wherever we get one, you know, you get into a place where you can have the conversation with people about social inclusion, about representation, you know, and about how these things are not terrifying because, you know, social change is taking place in a very safe and stabilised economic place with opportunity where nobody feels like they're losing anything if the conversation around a social issue changes.
And that's why it's so important. You know, that's why it's absolutely vitally important that the Labor left focus always has a core economic component, because creating that core economic stability gives people the freedom and the security to engage with these cultural issues. And we saw that with Hawke and Keating, and Hawke's ability to, just to bring it back to what you said before about Howard campaigning against Asian immigration, Hawke's ability to shut that down.
And he did. He smacked it to the ground.
Was based on, we are going to look after your economic interests. This is fear-mongering and trying to scare you about your economic future. Well, we're here to deliver you a more positive economic future, and we're going to do that together.
And you look at Hawke in particular with the Tiananmen Square situation, where when Tiananmen Square, the massacre of Chinese pro-democracy protesters happened in Beijing, he just instantly offered refugee status and permanent residence to all Chinese students studying in Australia. Like, you have a home here. And was there an outcry? Of course there wasn't an outcry, because we were in a position where, as a community, the public were comfortable in the narrative of opportunity and in the narrative of Medicare and the narrative of expanding TAFE and education opportunities, all those things, to realise that as Australia we had a capacity to make those kind of progressive social decisions.
And I think that's a really good place to end that conversation and to move on to some good news, because I think that's a really positive way to think about how we can deal with these issues going into the future. But what's the good news this week, Van?
It's about the Northern White Rhino, Ben. And the Northern White Rhino has been in serious trouble for some time.
Two left?
There are only two left.
And they're both females, aren't they?
And they're both females. And
that would normally spell extinction.
That would normally spell extinction. And obviously it's been looking like extinction land for some time. These are amazing, beautiful creatures, which have just been, they're suffering from habitat loss as, you know, unrestrained development rips across their grazing lands. And of course, the insane hunting of rhinoceroses, you know, based in sort of folk medicine practices, when to obtain their horns, when their horns are just basically keratin. Like, you would get the same effect from eating your own fingernails as you do from rhino horn.
Yeah.
So they've been absolutely decimated as a population, but the world is determined. Science is determined to bring them back. And the good news is that they are going through IVF. So the only two northern white rhinos that still exist, the two female ones, a number of eggs have been fertilised with sperm that was taken from a male white rhino back in 1980.
Wow.
Who's been dead for a very long time.
Yeah.
And they're going to be using surrogates from the southern white rhino population. And they've got an international program, and they're going to try and bring them back.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, IVF for the northern white rhino. And obviously what it means is that this is, you know, not rhino exclusive. It means that these kind of technologies can be used to restabilize populations of animals, because obviously when you take an animal out of an ecosystem, it has like
massive knock-on effects. Yeah.
And this is why you've seen some other good news was that our friend from Colorado got to vote on a measure in the American election, because they have all of those crazy referenda who that are on the ballot as well as president and everything else, where she got to vote to reintroduce wild coyotes.
Oh, yes.
Or wolves. Was it wolves or coyotes?
I can't remember now. I think it was coyotes.
It might be coyotes. No, it's wolves. It's definitely wolves. Yeah, to Colorado because the population of the little animals that the wolves eat has massively expanded and they're eating crops and wreaking havoc and creating environmental disasters. And that passed, so mm-hmm. they are reintroducing wolves to Colorado. And in Scotland, they're going to have a referendum on the reintroduction of the lynx. They're going to bring back the big cats to Scotland, which is so exciting. And these kind of ecologically sensitive reintroductions are made possible even with really declining numbers of animals because of technology. And things like IVF technology hopefully will restore the northern white rhino population.
That's fantastic news.
It made me so happy.
Such good news. Even Germanicus looks happy about that, although I'm not sure that he would appreciate confronting a wolf or a...
northern white rhino.
Yeah, northern white rhino. He's just a little...
I think you could take the baby. You can do it.
Well, that is The Week on Wednesday. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate everybody rejoining us after the Christmas break. Don't forget to share this episode on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram via Spotify.
If you can hear weird snuffly noises, it's because the dog has his nose against the microphone and he's too cute for me to rip him away.
And don't forget to talk about these issues with your friends, with your family, with your co-workers. And if you do have any questions for us, any topics you think we should be covering off,
any cute animal stories,
do drop us a line. We really appreciate all the feedback we get throughout the week, and do bear with us, we can't always get back to you straight away. We will try, but we really appreciate everybody listening. So that is The Week on Wednesday for this week, folks. Love you, Vanny.
I love you too.
Bye.
Bye. Say goodbye, Jim. Bye.